The US is a super wealthy country by most standards. It's the biggest economy in the world by a decent margin. It's really developed and its workers earn far more than other countries, even other developed economies. However, Americans do have a problem. They die really, really young. Throughout the 60s and 70s, US life expectancy broadly tracked with other European countries. But from the 80s, those two things began to diverge quite severely. And today, if you're American, you can expect to live a full 4 years less than comparable countries. The average American has the same health-adjusted life expectancy as someone who was born in Blackpool, the town in England that has the lowest life expectancy. You probably won't be surprised to hear that this doesn't affect everyone equally. So if you are a poor American, you lose a full decade of life compared to the richest Americans. But even they aren't completely safe, because the wealthiest Americans still live shorter lives than the wealthy in other countries. There's basically like an America tax that you have to pay, where instead of paying with money, you pay with years of your life. Obviously, the US doesn't have like the best reputation as things stand for healthy lifestyles, but it's worth investigating why this difference is really so dramatic. So I guess the best place to start is to figure out like who's dying. Because while even childhood mortality rates are above comparable countries in the US, the situation is improving at a similar rate to what we'd expect compared to other comparable countries. Things begin to change quite a lot when you look at young adults though, specifically any adult that's before retirement age. They don't seem to have enjoyed this benefit at all, really. The premature death rate is currently around twice what you'd expect. And it really is just a handful of things that's pushing people over the edge. There's a term called deaths of despair. It was coined by two economists, Case and Deaton, in reference to rising mortality rates, specifically around white Americans who lived in former industrial heartlands. In these industrial heartlands, the mortality rate for white non-Hispanics had actually steadily been dropping when you looked at things like heart disease. But that improvement in reduction of heart disease rates was completely offset by a rise in drugs, alcohol, and suicide deaths. These deaths were together considered like deaths of despair, and are in large part responsible for the outsized difference that we see in the US. This term, this idea of deaths of despair, was in some part reflecting what had happened in other communities previously. It had a lot of resonance with what happened in the African American community in the late 60s and 70s. And the study authors seem to agree. In those decades, manufacturing jobs were lost and black people were the first to lose their jobs. They were forced to take worse ones, and many had very bad work prospects and drug addiction issues. And today, this phenomenon of like deaths of despair, deaths from firearms, deaths from drugs and alcohol, has spread pretty dramatically. Loneliness and mental health is at a pretty bad spot, especially for the youngest and even for some of the elderly. And in some parts of the US, you'll be hard pressed to find someone who doesn't at least know someone who's succumbed to one of these, right? In terms of how bad the scale of drug overdoses actually is, they've been the number one killer of adults under 45 in the US for a while now. And the opioid crisis specifically is a uniquely American issue. The short version is that Purdue Pharmaceutical, which was run by the billionaire Sackler family, spent a very long time promoting OxyContin as a supposedly safe drug when it was really super addictive. And for years, they systematically like downplayed the risks and overplayed the benefits. This eventually came to a head after a spike in people overdosing on legal opioids. And suddenly, a lot of people saw their supply either cut off completely, or they were switched over to tamper-resistant versions of the drug that couldn't be abused. This sudden cut-off of supply effectively created the illegal market. Just as the supply of OxyContin was being cut off, synthetic opioids, which were much stronger and much cheaper to manufacture, was on the up. And so a lot of people went from a legal opioid to, say, heroin to fentanyl, and a lot of those didn't survive. But alcohol as well is in the same bucket. And just between 2017 and 2021, the number of deaths in the US from excess alcohol use went up 29%. Life expectancy is one of those issues where it can feel like everybody has an opinion. And to get the full picture, you really need to go beyond individual sources and critically analyze multiple perspectives. A really good tool to help you achieve that is Ground News. They're a website and app founded by a former NASA engineer, and they gather global news from across the political spectrum and have kindly sponsored this video. For example, when it was revealed that the wealthiest Americans live shorter lives than the poorest Europeans. 16 left-leaning outlets reported the story, compared to just 8 right-leaning sources. And while left-leaning sources were more likely to include comparisons of the American healthcare system with other international systems, like the Nordic one, centrist and right-leaning outlets focused more on describing the impact on America's wealthiest people, more specifically. Ground News is really good at providing context, like the political bias and reliability of each outlet listed on the website. It helps you stay better informed, and thanks to their blind spot feature, they give you access to stories that you've likely missed based on your own specific biases. Like, for example, this really handy story about major updates to California's high-speed rail project, which was barely reported by left-leaning outlets. They've helped me a ton, and if you're interested, then you can go to ground.news/fads for a better way to stay informed. Subscribe through my link to get 40% off unlimited access to worldwide coverage. Thanks to Ground News for sponsoring the video. Let's get back to it. Obviously, the one thing you want to do when you face a mental health crisis like this is to give everyone a gun, right? That always makes everything better. And collectively, it does seem like the American people have decided as a group that having a gun is worth the cost to society. But I think it's at least worth running through what that cost actually is. When looking at comparable countries, the US has the highest rate of firearm deaths, and it's nearly 5 times higher than that of the second highest country. It's not a homicide rate that's similar to its peer countries. It's closer to one that you would expect from a country that has experienced like serious political instability. There are enough guns in the US today to give one gun to everyone in America and give one to everyone in the UK. It's a bit mad. It is a bit mad. The cost of these three things is so significant that even without the COVID pandemic, the US still would have seen a drop in life expectancy over 2019 and 2020, just because opioids and gun deaths were so extreme. But it's only one half of the question, because as well as considering the scale of the problems, you have to also consider the effectiveness of the solutions. How good have the solutions been at putting downward pressure on these issues? It's not like the fentanyl crisis, for example, is like new information to anyone. You've likely heard all sorts of different causes and places in the world blamed for the fentanyl crisis. And as we said, fentanyl deaths have actually dropped for the first time as of the last year, but nobody really knows 100% why this has happened. And so it is worth looking at the problems, but it's also worth considering what's being done. The first place to start really is this statistic, which always blows my mind when I see it. It compares the healthcare spending in the US per person to other similar countries. And you can see that the US on average spends triple what a country like Italy or South Korea does on healthcare. But even as a percentage of their economy, as a proportion of the size of the US economy, it still vastly overspends to provide a service that doesn't cover everyone. Obviously, part of this is simply due to the US being a richer country where everything costs more. Whether it's the labor, the services, surgeries, all of that stuff just costs more. Labor costs are actually like a significant proportion of what medical centers spend. But a lot of that labor costs isn't necessarily medical staff. Physician income makes up around 7% of healthcare expenditure. But one thing that stands out in the US that doesn't in other countries is just the absolute human cost of insurance. Every medical system has to deal with people of varying insurance status. Some are uninsured, some have Medicare, some have Medicaid, some have employer insurance or individual insurance plans. And the fact that every medical system in the country has to deal with half a dozen different types of plans, each of which can be provided by, in some cases, dozens of different potential providers, all of this serves to push up the costs in a very indirect way, because higher wages in the US and higher labor costs for medical services in the US are consistently tied to administrative costs. Not just administrative costs of managing a hospital, but things like billing, insurance, marketing, enrollment, and quality measurement. These costs that are all tied not necessarily to delivering the care, but to this other industry that's like attached to the healthcare system, the insurance industry. It's especially significant when you consider that healthcare costs are the number one cost of bankruptcy for American families, and the simple fact that such a large proportion of patients are expected to at some point default on their loans pushes up the costs for everyone else, because this risk has to be priced in to everyone else's insurance plan. All of these issues have been incredibly well documented in the past. And even over a decade ago, back in 2013, the National Research Council published this incredibly long report, literally hundreds of pages, describing this very problem. And so it's useful to consider why nothing's been done about it. About a decade after this study was published, NPR interviewed the original authors and got their takes as to why so little had been done. Part of the issues, as a few of the professors point out, is that the difference in interests between the people who hold the money and the people who do the research can sometimes be quite stark. One of the authors talks about going to a meeting in Washington to discuss life expectancies in the wake of this report. And this is what she had to say. She says that it was a relatively small meeting, but we brought experts from Canada. An official at the time gave what she called a typical response, saying, "Oh, we can't have anything but an American solution to these issues. We can't listen to other countries." The problem with foreign countries is that they're not in someone's congressional district. Knowing the problem is a totally different basket of issues than solving the problem. The people who know what needs to be done are not the ones who are able to necessarily do the things on the ground. One of the authors of the Deaths of Despair paper, which defined the term, spoke in an interview as well about why he felt very little had been done. And he says that after publishing this paper, which showed that so many parts of industrial America were struggling with deaths from firearms, drugs, and alcohol, only one congressman actually just picked up the phone and called him. The man named Keith Ellison, who was a representative in Minnesota, I believe, because his constituents were some of the hardest hit. The things that people care about who control the purse strings are often just so different from the things that the scientists on the ground likely believe would be most effective. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, for example, is like by far one of the biggest funders of health research. And they've given billions and billions towards scientists, which, you know, is a good thing. I'm always pro-scientists getting more funding. But it also means that these scientists are constrained to appeal to whatever the Bill and Melinda Gates' Foundation's priorities are. And they aren't necessarily the same as what scientists believe would be most effective. Sometimes it overlaps, but there are a lot of cases where this doesn't overlap. And you have to appeal to whoever holds the purse strings. And so the next steps, the actual complicated bits, just never see the light of day because they're not as flashy as the actual landmark research paper. As an example, the US has way more road deaths than other countries. And to change that, you'd have to fundamentally change how American society interacts with cars. For trips that are shorter than a mile, 70% of Americans use their car, whereas 70% of Europeans would walk, bike, or use public transport instead. That's a pretty stark difference. It's a difference that needs like a fundamental rethink in how cities are designed and how jobs are structured and things that are way beyond the purview of a small team of scientists. At that point, you start crossing the barrier of public health and medical advice and instead having to deal with lobbyists and politicians and industry groups and just regular citizens who like their cars. All of this to achieve a benefit that the average American doesn't want or doesn't know that they want, which is the big barrier. The people that know the solutions don't have the funds to actually make a material difference. And to a large part, it seems that a lot of the average citizens on the ground just like don't really care about gun deaths or drug overdoses enough for that to be a voting priority. Unfortunately, at the end of the day, the people who bear the bulk of this burden are the poor in America who do live a full decade less than billionaires. And a big gap does mean a lot of opportunity to close it. Whether that gets done at the end of the day is another question, but I guess we'll see.